Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Transforming Residential Care conference call. At this time, all lines will be in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session. During those sessions, all lines will be open. If you do not wish to ask a question, please mute your line during the question-and-answer session. If you do not have a self-muting feature on your phone, you may press star then six to mute and unmute your line. At any time, if you need operator assistance, you may press star then zero, and an operator will assist you. As a reminder, this conference may be recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Mary O'Brien. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you very much, Tanisa. Tanisa, can I just ask you, I'm still looking for Bob Lieberman, and I want to make sure he gets into the call. So, do you see him yet?
Let me check for you, ma'am. One moment.
Okay, and just keep an eye out for him. Thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Mary O'Brien, and I'd like to welcome everyone to today's call on Transforming Residential Care, Building an Array of Community-Based Services, sponsored by the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, which goes by the acronym of NRCOI, the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement. Across the country, child welfare agencies are working on making this transformation to transform their service delivery systems to make sure that children and families get individualized services that meet their needs, and as part of this, to make sure that residential care is used only when necessary and that it is part of a broad continuum of community-based services available to children and families. To explore this topic, we wanted to give you some information about some of the things going on nationally and in specific places, and some inspiration that it is possible to transform residential care and service delivery systems in this way. So what we're going to do is give you a national, state, and provider perspective on this topic. We have a wonderful panel of people today who will each speak briefly and then take questions. We're going to start today with a national perspective from Gary Blau, who is the chief of the Adolescent and Family Branch for the Center for Mental Health Services in the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which is a federal agency that oversees mental health services. He has been leading a national effort called Building Bridges that he is going to tell us about today. Then we'll have a state-level perspective from Kathy Moles, who is the executive director of the Social Services Administration for the Department of Human Resources in the state of Maryland. They've been working hard with staff and providers to transform their systems, and we're going to hear about those efforts. Then, from a provider perspective, we'll have two people speak with us. First, we'll have Jerry Doyle, who is Chief Executive Officer of EMQ Children and Family Services in California. He'll talk about his experience of transitioning his agency from a traditional residential campus to providing a broad array of services, and give some advice to public child welfare agencies about what they can do to help providers move in this direction. We also have on our agenda Bob Lieberman, who we haven't heard his voice yet, but I think he'll be here. He is the public policy chair for the American Association of Children's Residential Centers and the executive director of the Southern Oregon Adolescent Study and Treatment Center. The plan is to have him talk about the commitment of the association to transforming residential services and his experience with applying the Building Bridges concepts in his agency. Before we begin, I just want to go over a couple of logistics. We did expect to have, you know, close to or over 100 lines open for today's call. So we are keeping the lines closed to keep background noise down to a minimum so we can all hear the speakers. But at the end of each person's presentation, we'll open the lines for questions, and we do encourage questions and discussion. With the number of people on the line, we won't get to all the questions. So if you find that you have something pressing that's relevant to, you know, nationally to other places, I would encourage you to send an email to the Help Kids address, which is on our website, which I'll tell you about in a minute. You know, you feel free to send a question that way, and I'll try to compile them and get some answers posted on our website. So on the line today, we are not going to do any kind of roll call, but we do have a lot of participants on the line from a variety of states. We see from a number of states, we have a lot of state, county, and provider representatives, which is great because that's the partners you want to have involved in this conversation. We have a big contingent registered from Maine and also from Virginia. and also quite a number of people from Pennsylvania, Texas, Florida, and Massachusetts, and many, many other states with a few people represented. So welcome to all of you. We're really glad you're here today. I was also glad to see a couple of family organizations registered. That's a really important voice to include in this conversation. We also have a number of mental health agencies represented, and I hope you all find this relevant to you. Our resource center, NRCOI, is funded to provide technical assistance to child welfare agencies, but because of the way that placement and funding for services works in a lot of states, your children's mental health folks are really critical partners. So we're really glad they're here today, and welcome, extend a welcome to those folks as well. Before we begin, I just want to tell you about some of the background material we gathered for today's call. These handouts are available on our website. The link was in the email that you got with the phone number for today's call. But if you haven't seen the material or want to look it up either now or later, I'm going to give you the website address. The simplest way is to go to our website, which is www.nrcoi, National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, nrcoi.org, and click on teleconferences and then look under November 13th. So that's just some background in terms of where the background material is. So that's great. So again, thank you everyone for being here. And I think with that, we will begin. So I'll turn it over to Gary Blau.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Mary, and welcome to everybody from all over the country who is interested in this topic. And I think that it is a very timely discussion, and I also think that it's a very challenging discussion that perhaps we're going to have today. Just as an aside, or they asked me a little bit of my background, I am the chief of the Child, Adolescent, and Family branch here at SAMHSA. However, before taking this job a little over 3 years ago, I spent 10 years with the state of Connecticut with the Department of Children and Families in a state position that was very much involved with not only mental health, juvenile justice, and substance abuse, but primarily with child welfare. So I am personally familiar with how to deal with the Child and Family Services reviews, having participated in the development of a PIP, as an example. I also was responsible for child fatality reviews, as well as for program review and activities about facilities and licensing facilities in the state of Connecticut, and that included residential, group homes, shelter care, et cetera. So I've been involved with this for some time, and I'm going to start off today by talking a little bit briefly about issues that we are seeing within residential care. Then I want to move into this concept of linking residential and community care. And then finally, we'll really sort of move into some of the details that Jerry and Kathy Bob have, how they're doing it at both the state and the provider level. I think that from my perspective, it's really critical when we think about issues in residential care that for most of us historically, one of the significant ones has been length of stay. And I think that we are seeing reductions of inpatient care, and at the same time that we've seen some reductions in inpatient services and certainly a huge reducing of the length of stay in inpatient, we've actually seen some expansion in residential treatment. And that expansion primarily has occurred in the juvenile justice and child welfare arenas. As part of that expansion, we also have to be very much concerned with how long youngsters are staying. And people will argue with me, at least in the past, about, well, we have nowhere to discharge somebody to. And, certainly those are real issues that we have as the length of stays have increased. We also have some good practices or best practices that where folks have really done an amazing job. Maybe Jerry will talk about this around finding families for youngsters and strategies to reduce those length of stays. The other area that I think is major issue nationally, of course, is seclusion and restraint. Coming from Connecticut, many of you have historically read the Hartford Current articles. I personally was very involved with that in the death of Andrew McLean, who was in one of our hospital settings. And although we did not license hospitals in my department, Andrew was a committed child and was when he died as a result of a restraint situation, it was very much incumbent upon us to address those issues. Well, seclusion and restraint remains a major concern for us, as well as many national advocacy organizations and the like, and tracking those issues, tracking the kinds of concerns that happen when youngsters get restrained, et cetera. I think that those continue to be something that we have to focus attention on. A third area is the current concerns, and there's been some recent public hearings on congressional public hearings on non-licensed residential providers. And oftentimes these providers will identify themselves as like boarding schools or some kind of a school situation. And there's been some highly publicized deaths in some of these facilities. And it's caused, I think, a variety of responses, namely that most of the major national organizations that I deal with around residential treatment have come out indicating that all of their members must be licensed, and that it really is something that we have to ensure that the facilities that we deal with are certainly licensed, if not accredited as well, and meet all of the standards and regulations that, you know, that govern the use of residential treatment centers. Going on beyond those issues is something near and dear to my heart, which is the current and the ongoing, I think the requirement is probably too strong a word. I would like to see it that way, but that residential treatment begin to and continue their efforts to become much more family-driven and youth-guided. And by that, I mean that in my work here at the federal government, we have significant initiatives around how families, and it, you know, again, I come from a child welfare background, and I've reminded my staff, my workers, many times that, you know, even when we take children out of their homes, that we can still engage and respect families, and that we need to figure out ways to work with families on partnering on the process of treatment and improvement and aftercare, et cetera. In the mental health world, certainly, families have to be at the table, have to be involved. I think that families really do offer not only advocacy and the ability to share information from their perspective, but can add a great deal of value about what works and what doesn't work. And I think most of the child and family service review kinds of planning asks questions about how are families involved in these action plans and stuff. And I ask that same question of residential facilities. And truthfully, over the years, the last couple of years, it has started with a real smattering, and there's a few residential facilities that say, oh, yeah, you know, I have a family member that I ask questions to, or maybe they're even on their board. And I think that we have to engage much more with consumers of services and family members as part of the residential services, and I think that's another major national issue that we see, as well as this concept of being youth-guided. Are there youth advisory boards that are involved? Do they have youngsters that participate literally in the governance of agencies and of facilities and ask questions? Notice I don't say family-driven and youth-driven. I talk about family-driven and youth-guided care. And that's because, of my family. My kids are over the driving age, and driving was a real privilege in my family. And, you know, they had to earn that. And based on the developmental level, you know, a youngster, even a seven-year-old, can help to define, well, what is it that we're doing in treatment? What games do we play? Those sorts of things. And an older child may be able to direct their treatment more and talk more about setting goals and participating in that, as certainly even an older, a developmentally ready youngster may help to drive some of their care and even not only participate in meetings but really focus on what happens with them, both in facility and post-residential stays. So, again, length of stay issues, seclusion and restraint, family-driven youth-guided care, licensing of facilities. And then I'm going to add another one to my list of national issues, and that has to do with the research on the effectiveness of residential treatment. And this is a really challenging topic area for many residential providers, because although there are some data indicating that a youngster's participation in residential, their behavior, their emotional functioning, et cetera, improves from the time that they enter to the time that they leave, there is much less, if any, data that really identifies the longer-term effectiveness of residential treatment. There are huge differences in the models across residential treatment centers. There are just now becoming some ideas around evidence-based practices or clinically excellent services and things like the teaching family model or things that happen within the residential facility, like the use of cognitive behavioral interventions and things of that nature. But the reality is that there's just not great data about the effectiveness. And this is an argument that I have made with the residentials, that there has to be better research about what really works. And I think that as part of contracting, as far as like state governments or counties that contract with residentials, my personal policy desires is to see some dollars go to aftercare and longer or longitudinal kinds of reviews of youngsters. Some facilities do better at this than others. Some have more money to do this than others. But truthfully, if we're not taking a longer-term approach at understanding what works, then we don't know whether the hundreds of dollars a day that go for treatment and education and board and care and those things, are we really spending our money judiciously? So anyway, those are some of our issues. And at the same time that we have all of these serious and significant issues that, most of us would agree that residential treatment needs to be part of our overall array of services, that, there are times when youngsters simply because of their own safety or the public safety really do need a 24-hour care type of a setting where we certainly, at least as a staff secure model, are able to maintain that kind of security. And at the same time that we focus and try our best to do community interventions, that I personally would not, be comfortable with seeing all of our residential facilities go out of business. And I think that's something that would be concerning to most all of us in this business. But it is a topic. Residential facility or residential treatment and the tension between residential and communities does bring up a lot of passions. But it is not a topic that we should shy away from, because I believe that transforming children's mental health, we have to include all of these partners in our dialogue. And unfortunately, for too long, there has been this tension and frankly, an adversarial relationship between community and residential providers. And about 2 years ago, along with several folks at a national level, we really wanted to change that. We wanted to bring the idea of system of care philosophies about family-driven and youth-guided care, cultural and linguistic competency, and we wanted to move those into facilities, and we wanted the communities to also benefit from the expertise and the commitment that has been present within facilities. Because many residential programs are already embracing the challenge of doing this work. I think long gone are the days where we simply have one residential treatment center and that's all that they do. Most of them now are multi-service agencies. And so as a system, it became clear that we needed to sort of stand united in the cause of bringing all of the array of services together. Creating a circle around, an old boss of mine used to talk about how our mental health providers and folks are really good at doing a firing squad while in a circle. So I'll let you think about that one for a second. But our goal was to link these residential and community service providers with families, with youth, because they're not going away. Our residential facilities have 100-year-plus histories of providing services, and we do need to link them together. So we created this concept of what we call the Building Bridges Summit. And this was in order to address these historical tensions. A group of leaders in children's mental health met that included some of the community thinkers, people that have been involved in the systems of care movement for many years, people like Bob Friedman, Sheila Pyres, Beth Stroll, Sybil Goldman, along with major leaders in the residential world, folks that came from the American Association of Children's Residential Centers, the Alliance for Children and Families, the Child Welfare League of America, the Residential Care Consortium, the National Association of Children's Behavioral Health. And all came together. Actually, we came together in Omaha, Nebraska, of all places, mainly because one of the residential providers there who was trying to do a lot of important things was willing and able to host us. And we got a significant commitment from many foundations across the country to bring families and young people who themselves have had histories in residential facilities to the table to talk about what things could be done to improve this relationship and to improve services. We had the Annie E. Casey Foundation, the Jim Casey Opportunities Fund, Presley Ridge, Devereaux, the Utah Holly Cooper Village Foundation, the foundation out of Oregon called CHARP. Anyway, they all ponied up some money, and the idea at first was to establish some consensus related to values, philosophies, and services, and also to look at best practices and to look at action steps for the future. And post that sort of historic meeting that a lot of, I think, really good work was done, we created the joint resolution that I hope many of you, as part of your preparation for this meeting, have downloaded. Now, the joint resolution itself across all of these providers is certainly not, you know, the definitive answer to what, you know, needs to be done. But what it does is it shapes the values and solutions and the values and philosophies into potential solutions on how to address this. It can be used as training tools. It can be used as contracting information about things that folks would want to see out of their residential facilities. And we asked for a commitment to from organizations. Are they willing to endorse the joint resolution? And at this point, not only have all of the major national organizations of residential care, the ones that I mentioned before, endorsed the resolution. I don't have all the list in front of me, but the International Society of Psychiatric Nurses has endorsed the resolution. The National Alliance for Mental Illness, NAMI, the Federation of Families, Mental Health America, which used to be the National Mental Health Association. I mean, advocacy organizations, provider organizations, all have come together to endorse this, as well as several states or subdivisions of states that are using the joint resolution now as part of their activities. Rather than resting on our laurels this past September, we held the second summit also at in Omaha. And out of that came, I'm hoping that there will be several documents, one related specifically to innovations and best practices that that will be finalized, another one that's related to outcomes and how we together can create community outcomes that people can agree with, and to utilizing the joint resolution as a evaluation tool for agencies themselves that are interested in transforming and using those values, principles, and philosophies. So we have several work groups going on right now as a result of this. There will be these documents that now are looking at ways to make sure that the field understands and gets there's some dissemination of the information that's been provided. In addition to that, I'll end with three points. One is that folks can find information about not only this topic, but a lot of our topics that we deal with in my branch at www.systemsofcare.samhsa, which is samhsa.gov. So again, that's www.systemsofcare, all one word, .samhsa.gov. It can also work if you just do soc.samhsa.gov. And secondly, that in July of 2008, our team of folks that have been invested in talking about these issues will be going to the National Training Institutes, which will be in Nashville, Tennessee, in July of 2008. Some of you may know historically the Training Institutes is really our, every other year, our seminal event around children's mental health issues, and the day before the actual institute start, we're having a major pre-institute on residential treatment, bringing in a lot of these providers of care and family and youth, et cetera, to continue these efforts. The training institutes this year will have three themes, a public health theme, a school-based mental health theme, and a child welfare theme. And the submissions of institutes, et cetera, are going to be done in those topic areas. So people may be interested in participating in doing that. And then the last thing is that we just issued, my branch just issued, through government agencies. The eligible applicant is government agencies, a new request for applications for our systems of care program. Folks can find that on www.samhsa.gov, which is our SAMHSA website, and click on grants and then on funding opportunities, and you can download the new RFA that just came out within the last week or so about systems of care and the creation of this sort of broad array and network of services in local communities. So anyway, it's a lot of information in my brief, 20 or so minutes to talk about our goals around national agenda and continuing our efforts to link residential and community providers together and the many, many very important and good folks that have been working on this. So thank you very much for the opportunity to share these details. Mary, I'll turn it back to you.
That's great, Gary. Thank you. Attorney, so let's see if we can open the line and see if people have any questions for Gary. Can we do that? Trinisa?
All lines are now open.
Wonderful. Okay. So remember to do *6 to mute if you're not, if you don't have a question and you have some background noise going on. Does anybody out there have a question, questions for Gary Blau?
Hello?
Yes, hi.
This is Nancy Martin. I'm calling in from New York City.
Yes.
And I'm just curious whether the focus of the work, the Building Bridges work, is residential treatment, if it's just on sort of RTC programs, or if you mean that more broadly to include other kinds of settings like group homes, group residences that are also sometimes part of the whole continuum of residential care.
That's a good question, and my answer to that would be is that the joint resolution is pretty broad-based, and it really does reflect the kinds of values and principles that would really be for any type of 24, hour care facility or anything else. So, there are certainly group homes that provide treatment or obtain treatment from the community. There are other, shelters or diagnostic centers or emergency placements and things. So I think that there is broad applicability to this. So we use the term residential treatment pretty broadly.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Are there other questions out there? The lines are open and interactive, so you can speak up if you have a question. If you're speaking at your site, please use your mute button.
Yes. This is Larry Tasty from New York, and you mentioned you had a work group that was going to be looking at community outcomes. And I guess a question is that also going to look at the issue of specific outcomes within the 24-hour care setting? And are you also interested in paying from the federal level for work with either states and or providers to help identify what those outcomes might be in the residential and how you carry them forth into the community?
Well, one at a time, I think that that the answer is yes. I think the Bob Lieberman, if he's joining, can talk. He chairs the group that's specifically dealing with outcomes. And one thing that we're really trying not to do is to just say, okay, we're totally focused on residential treatment, because we believe that it has to be a community. It has to be sort of the whole concept of creating outcomes that communities can buy into as well. So it is, I think, a little broader than that, although there is a reality that we do focus more on the residential side of things in terms of what the matrix that they're coming up with of benchmarks and indicators might be, because historically there's been some real, less work done in that area. In terms of financing, those sort of things, that's a million-dollar question. My agency doesn't actually provide funding for, residential or others. There are some strategies to do that. There are the other federal agencies that I know of are challenging in terms of the financing. That's a nice way for me to say this. As far as getting some of those kinds of reimbursements, I know that through our system of care program, our RFA, we do fund evaluation activities specifically as part of that program. So there are, possibilities, I think, on a more specific level. But it is a challenge to find and to maintain those kinds of dollars. So not a great answer for that last question, but that's the reality.
This is Mary O'Brien again. Is Bob Lieberman there? Not yet. Okay. Great. Are there other questions for Gary?
Gary, since there was a slight pause, this is Larry Tass again. Let me just ask one more, because I was looking at your RFA, and you mentioned including youth in the juvenile justice system, child welfare system. Your response to earlier was that it's any 24-hour care, not just the mental health system. Can you just talk a minute about your conversations at the federal level with the other federal agencies and whether or not they're buying into this building bridges and your whole initiative?
Sure. I mean, the answer is yes. Other federal agencies are, I think, you know, certainly interested, invested, partnering with us. We have something called our Federal National Partnership. This last year, in fact, as an example, we had a huge youth summit and, you know, the youth guided care with the Department of Labor. And we're involved with education around school-based mental health issues. And we're working across agencies, including the CDC and others around early identification and screening. And I think that we're coming up with strategies that we're doing better at working together. And philosophically, I think that we are in consistent places. Now, the current challenge, of course, is that while we have some philosophical consistencies, we are all struggling around the reality of our budget issues. And so, you know, from that perspective, it becomes more of a challenge. But certainly on a philosophical value-oriented level, I think that we're doing a really good job of staying on the same page.
Okay, great. This is Mary O'Brien. Trinisa, I'm going to ask you again to close the lines, and I think we'll move on at this point just so we make sure to get everybody gets the chance to speak. We'll close the lines, and I'm going to turn this over, and thank you very much, Gary, for the presentation and answering questions. I want to turn this over now to Kathy Moles from Maryland to talk with us about her experience in that state.
Great. I appreciate that, Mary. Thanks so much. This is Kathy Moles. I'm the State Child Welfare Director here in Maryland, and I wanted to share with our callers from across the country about an initiative that Maryland's undertaken called Place Matters. By way of a little background, I've been the Child Welfare Director here in Maryland since April, so it's been an interesting and challenging experience so far, but my background is in child welfare in Maryland, and I have been working in child welfare for more than 28 years here in the state and began my career in child protective services and foster care. And one of the pieces that comes to mind right now about my experience in foster care as it relates to our situation here in Maryland is during the time when I was placing children in foster care, I always placed children in family foster care during the period that I was doing foster care. I never placed children in group care or residential care. The first placement, and that was when I was a child protective service worker, was into a family foster home in the home jurisdiction where the child came from. And that at the time was Anne Arundel County, which is a fairly large metropolitan jurisdiction here in Maryland. That phenomenon, however, has changed greatly here in Maryland and is really at the heart of why we've undertaken our Place Matters initiative. In Maryland, we say that nothing matters more to a child than a place to call home. And at this point in time, our Place Matters initiative kicked off in April of this year. Place Matters in Maryland, because of the situation we've uncovered or discovered here in Maryland regarding our placement practices and priorities, we have somewhat gotten astray from the idea that children should be placed in families first whenever possible. In Maryland, we have about 10,000 children in out-of-home care, and about 60% of those children are from Baltimore City, and 40% of them are from our other remaining 23 counties here in Maryland. 61% of our children are currently in family foster care. That's the good news. However, 20% of our children are currently placed in group homes. And we know that, you know, looking across the nation and looking at what best practice is, we should probably be at around 10 to 12% in terms of the number of children we have in group homes. So we know that we need to do a little work there. We also have a very long average length of stay in care. Around 4 years right now in Maryland is our average length of stay for children in foster care. Some of the issues that we've identified here in Maryland and what we consider to be barriers right now are our lack of family foster homes, the fact that we have an over-reliance on group care, that we have developed a practice of really placing children in jurisdictions that are outside their home jurisdictions, away from their family, and not in close proximity to their homes. We know that we have serious gaps in our placement continuum that exist statewide, and we also know that we have really insufficient mental health services statewide, and that we also need to do a lot of work to develop educational supports for our foster children. At the present time, the goals of our Place Matters initiative are really keeping children in their communities, trying to make the first placement to be with families whenever possible, relatives, and family foster care. We want to try to reduce our reliance generally on out-of-home care, minimize our length of stay, manage with the data that we've collected about our entire continuum, and redirect the resources that we believe that we will be able to save to the prevention side of the continuum and to developing resources within the community. The framework for our Place Matters initiative really has about 9 cornerstones that we're working on. And as I said, we've only begun in April here in Maryland. We're looking at developing an alternative response process in Child Protective Services. We are rolling out our family-centered practice model here in Maryland. We're looking to integrate our in-home services and our family preservation services. We're working on developing specific targeted child well-being practices for all of our children in foster care. We are looking at expanding our foster care and adoption family recruitment and retention, fully developing our kinship care program, looking at placement and community resource development, and developing focus permanency policies and practice. So We have our work cut out for us. But in the beginning months of this, we have developed our Place Matters strategy. And we've begun to really analyze the data that we have available, both about our children in care and about our resource continuum. We've used a number of mechanisms to do that. We have done and had our local departments of social services conduct case-by-case reviews looking at permanency, looking at appropriateness of the placements in terms of the child's needs, and looking at the geographic proximity issue. We've been working with the Casey Strategic Consulting Group, and actually they're due to report out to us today on their findings. Our Governor's Office for Children has done a fairly extensive resource development plan that has provided us with important data. We have begun working more closely with the Maryland Foster Parent Association, which has been invaluable to us in terms of the information that they can give us around our family foster homes and particularly around retention. And we've done some pretty serious data collection in terms of requirements of our provider community, our group home providers, to do monthly census to us in terms of the children that are in their care, and also the same for providers of treatment foster care. And in those reports, we've begun to look at particularly our issue of jurisdiction of placement on children placed not in situations that are not close to their home. The major initiatives that we're really tackling in 2007 are a renewed foster parent recruitment and retention plan. We have a plan here in Maryland to bring in 1,000 new foster homes by the year 2010. We have seen an erosion of our family foster care system here in Maryland. As I said, we're expanding or implementing our family-centered practice model, which will involve not only training of our caseworkers, but obviously our foster care providers and our provider community at large. We are, in addition to that, implementing the service array process across Maryland in terms of developing resource development plans in each of our jurisdictions and really trying to target, in particular, mental health services and education services for our children in care. And we've been working very diligently with our provider community. We've developed a provider council here in Maryland where we can really talk about with our providers about the right sizing of the system that we're trying to do here in Maryland. As I said, one of our major issues is the number of children who are not close to home. So we know we have a couple of issues, one of which is a practice problem in terms of decision making that's going into where children are going. Oftentimes in Maryland, children go as their first placement into group care, into congregate care, and we're seeing that more and more. In addition, we see children's first placement being treatment foster care as opposed to family foster care. There are reasons for that that are both about practice and about policy, both that exist on the public child welfare side as well as on our private provider side. It has to do with the resources that are out there in Maryland and where they're located. So we have, as I said, both a practice improvement to make, but also a resource development improvement to make here in Maryland as well. We're working harder on provider accountability, and I think Gary talked a little bit about this, but we want to focus our provider community because in Maryland, almost all treatment foster care and all group care is privately provided. And we want to focus them on permanency and particularly on well-being issues for our foster children. In addition to that, we are looking to refine our contract monitoring process. We're developing a provider report card here in Maryland on quality issues and really working with the provider communities on our geographic proximity issues as well. In terms of practice improvement, we're focused on family-centered, community-based, child-focused practice. We want to develop more refined placement protocols. We're looking at the systems of care models and looking at levels of care and assessments that we should be doing for on our foster children when they're coming into care and at various points during the time that they are in care. And that's something we need to look at both on our public and our private side. And in addition to that, we're really looking at refining placement decision-making criteria, that those placements be needs-based and that proximity has to be a factor in the decision-making on placements. So those are just a few of what we're working at for 2007. And at this point, you know, I have to say that and to admit that when Mary O'Brien invited me on this conference call, I told her that we were in our very early stages of working on place matters here in Maryland, and that, in fact, I am going about and talking with various other states on different pieces of our place matters initiatives to get ideas and to get assessment tools and other helpful pieces for us here in Maryland. In particular, I want to thank the state of Utah as well as the state of Delaware, who we're visiting at the end of the month. We've been to Utah in terms of their assistance and their openness in where they have perfected and really worked out certain pieces of this. We are very grateful for their willingness to share. We'll be posting our Place Matters information on the National Resource Center website tomorrow. And I would just encourage anyone to email me if you can provide us with additional information that could help us as we move our strategy forward, as well as I'd be glad to take questions. Thanks, Mary.
That's great. Thank you, Kathy. Trinisa, we could open up the lines now for some questions.
All lines are open.
Great. Okay, thank you. So I don't know, I would ask if anyone has any questions out there for Kathy Moles from Maryland. So the lines are open for questions. If you're not going to ask a question, you can use *6 if there's background to mute, if there's background at your site. Are there any questions out there?
Probably next week.
Okay. This is Mary O'Brien. Kathy, maybe I thought one of the things that was interesting was the way that you've worked with your Foster Parent Association.
Yes.
Can you want to just tell them a little bit about that and the input you've gotten about what the needs are and how you're trying to respond to that?
Yeah, I think one of the pieces we looked at were sort of systemic improvements that we could make with our foster care program. And some of the things that have come out around that are the foster parents' need for respite care. That's been a big issue. In Maryland also, with so many of our foster parents who work, consistent child care subsidies for daycare has been an issue and something that we're moving to attempt to address in our next budget cycle here in Maryland. And in addition to that, I think probably the piece that will be most significant for family foster parents, and they've talked a lot about this, is the provision of mental health crisis response services to all of our foster parents here in Maryland. And we have been working collaboratively with the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene here in Maryland to build on their existing crisis response system to child and adolescents so that we can assure that response will be in place for all of our family foster care. That was really defined as sort of the number one of the number one issues that our foster parents talk to us about. And obviously, we also know that in terms of placement stability, if we can put those services in place at our family foster care level, we're much more likely to stabilize that placement. And then to try to, you know, make the bridge between what's happening in the family home and behavioral plans and that kind of thing that are put in place for the foster children, make that bridge with the school system so that we also stabilize the educational setting as well, and then everybody's really clear on what the needs are of the children, of the child, both at the home and the school setting. So we're excited about that collaboration, and we've also begun closer work with our State Department of Education around broadening their understanding of the needs of this particular population. They certainly are very supportive of our initiative to try to keep children in the community because it really challenges the educational system here in Maryland as we move our children throughout the state.
Great. Thank you.
This is Bob Lieberman. I actually have been on the call the whole time. I just called into the wrong number and couldn't be heard before, so I apologize for that.
Bob, welcome.
I just wanted to comment to you, Mary, that that all sounds really great, especially the broad degree of stakeholder involvement, the provider council, and working with the Foster Parent Association. And I'm speaking from perspective in Oregon, where we got some really great things going on and some opportunities to improve, one of which would be that kind of broad inclusion in looking at the direction that we're going with what we in Oregon are calling the Children's System Change Initiative. The other question I have is whether on the web link, which I haven't looked at, some of these documents are available, like the provider report card and some of the other things you referenced earlier, or if not, if there's a way to get them from you.
I think right now they're not. I don't. That is something that's still under development, the provider report card, so that isn't posted at this point in time. But I could certainly get information to you regarding what we're doing with that.
Bob, this is Jerry Dale at EMQ. We also in Santa Clara County has developed a provider report card process as well. So we could share that.
Well,
that'd
gosh,
be great.
My email is going to be posted. This is Kathy. If you would email me something, I would love that. Thank you.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll make sure that connection is made between Bob and the people at EMQ in Maryland.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Lisa in Richmond. How's everyone?
Hi.
Go ahead. Come in. I think her name is Mary on Maryland strategy. But I wanted to know what are some of the things that you're looking at in Delaware that are of interest for you?
And specifically in Delaware, we actually went out to look at the health care system that they had set up for children in foster care, since that's a major issue for us here in Maryland. And they have done a wonderful job in addressing that well-being issue in the Child and Family Service Review. So if that happens to be an issue for anyone, I encourage you to contact Utah. But also, while I was out there, they actually provided some information to me around their contract monitoring process. And also, I think they have established a utilization review process for their children in group care, which I think is very interesting and promising in terms of the well-being piece of children in care. In Delaware, I think maybe Gary could talk about this more. They have had a SAMHSA grant there where they've worked between mental health and child welfare in developing assessment levels for children coming into care. Maybe Gary knows more about that than I do specifically, but that's really what we're looking for in terms of the tools that they have been using to, when children come into care, to determine what level they need to be in, and that would obviously include looking at not only their placement level but their mental health needs. So that was my primary interest there.
Kathy, this is Bob Lieberman. Once again, and I might have missed it as you were talking earlier, but what are you guys doing to integrate the child welfare and the mental health systems and perspectives and cultures and all
yeah.
of that?
Well, we're just starting on that arena. We have in Maryland a mental health transformation grant, and as part of that piece, the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene that is the lead for that has kind of, as I would call it, has done a kind of carve out to work with us in order to focus efforts on just those kinds of issues of how we can do more collaborative processes between the two agencies in terms of assuring that children receive care. And so that has led to some other collaborations in terms of our plans to apply for some funding to do some specific work that would bring together sort of the systems of care concepts with our family-centered practice concepts. And so that's the work that we're doing right now with them. In addition, the collaboration has really brought about this whole plan around the crisis response so that we have looked to basically look at their funding and our funding together to see how we can build this response for all of our family foster parents. So it's really been looking at child welfare funding and DHMH, which and Medicaid funding, funded services that they're providing in the community already. So it's really the first time that we've sort of done that kind of work together, and they are very committed to helping us to, you know, I go to the meetings and say, you know, they say, what do you need? And I say, I need mental health services for our 10,000 children in foster care. It's the number one thing that I hear from our local directors, from our caseworkers. So it's across the board. In addition to that, we're looking sort of all along our continuum to see where there can be points of intervention. So, you know, because of our Place Matters strategy, I really started the discussion with them at the family foster care level. But our discussions have led us to looking at other places in the continuum where we have are using, you know, more high cost. We have respite care here in Maryland that is high cost respite care that is either can is we're, our children are in that level at times when they're awaiting placement into residential treatment. They're there for a variety of reasons, but we've begun to look at, you know, are there targets for wraparound services at any points of the continuum, are there, you know, and looking at the residential care piece as well. So it's brought about a discussion that's led us to what points should we intervene in along the continuum where children are placed in care, where can we have the best outcomes, and then not only that, but what resources do we need to develop in the community in order to make that happen? And that's where, you know, that's where I think our provider community in particular, you know, are very eager to have that conversation with us in terms of community-based services and the services that can be provided to both prevent children coming into care but also to return them to the community.
That's great. Kathy, this is Mary O'Brien. Kathy, thank you so much for telling us about your experience in Maryland and answering some questions. I'm going to suggest now that we move on and in hear from Jerry Doyle so that we can make sure to get through the people who are on the line to speak with us. So I'll ask the operator to close the lines again, I think, and we'll hear from Jerry Doyle.
Okay, thank you. East Woman Inquiring is a private nonprofit agency that was founded in 1867 as an orphanage. So it had, you know, bed-based services deep down in its roots for over 100 years. We had built over the years one of California's largest intensive residential treatment programs. We had 130 beds. All of the 130 beds were what are called rate classification level 14, which is the most intensive level of residential treatment. They're actually in statute called group homes in California, not residential treatment centers. But RCL 14 is the most intensive level. We had 130 RCL 14 beds, and we were dealing with pretty high-end kids. We had actually merged back in 1987 with another residential center. Eastfield and Min Kuang were two separate agencies that merged. And actually, as part of that merger, we worked with the people from the county, and we agreed that we would shape our services to meet the needs of the county mental health, social services, and probation departments, and that we had you know, all the physical plant, but we didn't have any money to pay for mental health services. And so we said that we'd be willing to only serve kids from Santa Clara County in a residential program and to shape the services to meet the kids that they had, if they would find a way to get us the mental health funding. We did that, and we built this huge residential treatment program, 130 beds with very, very high-end kids. we for a couple of years we thought it was a good idea. You know, we controlled 80% of the market of residential treatment back in the in the late 80s in this community. But a couple things happened. One is, you know, because we were the biggest game in town and we'd agreed to take any kid to send us, the county began to send us very, very difficult kids. That was exacerbated when the state decided to start charging counties a lot more money for placing kids in the state psychiatric hospitals. And so the county, because of the financial pressures from the state, decided to take all their kids out of the state hospitals and bring them back to the county, and they asked us to take all those kids. The big difference, of course, is state hospital is a locked psychiatric hospital with locked doors and bars on the windows and walls around the premises, and kids couldn't run away, whereas we were an open, unlocked community setting, and we began to experience a lot of difficulties just even trying to maintain control of the kids, let alone providing effective treatment. That eventually led us to think to ourselves, there's got to be a better way of dealing with these high-end kids. And we decided to go on a benchmarking process to look around the country, really in three or four other countries as well. And the question we asked is, who's getting the best outcomes with the most seriously disturbed kids, and how are they doing it? We looked at hundreds of different programs, but the ones that really stood out were wraparound programs. So we looked at the Kaleidoscope program in Chicago, Kyle Dennis's program. We looked at what Vermont was doing back at that time with John Burchard, and we looked at the Alaska Initiative with John Vandenberg. And we became convinced that we could get a lot better outcomes with a wraparound approach than we were getting with our residential treatment approach. EMQ has always been very, very focused on measuring outcomes to try to find out, are the kids getting better or not, and how do we know? And we've always had for many years, we've had a research department that tracks outcomes of our various programs, and we fund that ourselves because we haven't been able to find any kind of government money to fund it, although I think that's one thing government entities should be thinking about. We want to know what happens to the kids. We have to find a way to fund efforts of organizations and provider agencies to measure outcomes. At any rate, at the time, back in 1992, when we came to the conclusion we could get better outcomes with wraparound, there was no way to pay for wraparound in California. And we knew we couldn't. California is, you know, a county-driven system where the counties act as an arm of the state government, and they provide the mental health services and social services through county departments, which in turn contract with private nonprofit agencies to do much of the work. We knew we couldn't go to the county or to the state and say, hey, we got this new idea. Why don't you give us $10 million? We can try this wraparound thing and see if it'll work. We knew that wouldn't. If we tried that, they would pat us on the head and tell us to go away. So instead what we did is we went to the county and said, look, we had done extensive research. These are the kind of outcomes we're getting right now with this residential program. It was a well-staffed program and, you know, a well-executed program. But the outcomes simply weren't all that great. I think Gary Blau mentioned earlier, if you look at the evidence-based literature and the research, there's very, very little out there that says residential treatment programs get good outcomes. There are some exceptions to that, but by and large, there's little evidence that residential treatment programs get good outcomes. And, in fact, there is evidence that residential programs, congregate care, makes certain kinds of kids worse, especially kids with acting out behaviors, which many of our kids have got. It can actually make congregate care can actually exacerbate those behaviors in kids. Anyway, what we did is we went to the county and we said, look, we know you don't have any new money anywhere, so what we would like to do is close down 100 of our 130 beds. We would like you to continue to give us the same 60% of the rate that's paid by the county, and we would like you to go with us to the state to try to get the 40% that's paid by the state from the state. We'd also like to work with you, county, to figure out how we can bring in federal funds, Title 19 dollars in particular for mental health treatment, and possibly $40. So that's how we started out. The basic premise was, we're not asking for any more money or any new money. Give us the same money you're already giving us and let us spend it on wraparound instead of on residential treatment. So it basically was designed to be cost neutral. It wasn't designed to save money, and we were very careful not to make any promises that it would be cheaper. We didn't know whether it would be cheaper or not. And in fact, in the first 4 years that we did it, we lost a ton of money. Part of that was because once we got an agreement from the county that they would pay us their 60% share of the money, we went ahead and started the program, even though we knew we wouldn't have enough money to do it without the 40% from the state. But we went ahead and started shutting down beds. Before we started this effort, we had a budget of about $12 million a year, and 72% of the money came from our residential program. As we shut down 100 beds over a year and a half, which was pretty fast to shut down 100 beds, our revenue plummeted from $12 million a year down to $8 million a year, and we started running into serious, serious budget problems. We knew that we would have to go from the beginning. We knew we'd have to get the program up to at least 50 kids to create some economies of scale, and we'd have to have the state share of the money in order to make it fiscally viable. What we didn't know when we started was that it would take 2 years to make those two things happen. And, of course, this was back in 1993 when nobody in California was even talking about wraparound. Most people had never even heard of it, and the residential programs thought of it as a huge potential threat. Once we, you know, started the program, we started working on legislation. We started working to try to get the state share of the money. That effort is described in that Youth Today article that's on the website, so I won't get into all the details of that. But the bottom line was that it took 4 years to get the first piece of legislation passed. We had tried to do it three times through the state budget and came real close, but it didn't quite get there. And we tried two pieces of legislation that failed, partially due to a lot of resistance from the whole group home industry. And I had been the past president of our state association of residential treatment providers, and a lot of my friends in the group thought either I had gone mad or that I was a traitor, or maybe both. And there was a lot of unhappiness that from the group home folks that we were all going to take their already terribly insufficient funding and use it for something else that they never even heard of. It was not a welcome thing from our colleagues in the group home field. At any rate, one of the things we learned over 3 years that helped us get the legislation passed is if we try to do legislation that scares the whole group home industry, we're not going to be able to do it. So in the piece of legislation, AB 2297, that finally was successful, we made that a demonstration project of EMQ in Santa Clara County. It didn't affect any other group homes or any other providers. It didn't threaten anybody else. And so they could just kind of watch and see what happened. The other thing we learned, which was one of those kind of duh things, the first two times we tried to get legislation, we had Democratic legislators carry the legislation for us. At the time, Pete Wilson, a Republican, was the governor of California. And by the third go around, we had learned, and this is like a dumb, you know, better get a Republican legislator to carry the bill for you if you want the Republican governor to sign it. So we did get a Republican legislator who had friends in both parties, a moderate Republican, to carry the bill for us. And finally, in 1996, we got a law through the Assembly and the Senate without a single no vote, and the governor signed it in 1996. So it took 4 years. So in 1996, we both got the law passed, and we finally got up to 50 kids in wraparound, and we finally broke even. We ended up, we had kind of clawed our way back up to a $12 million a year revenue stream, which was what we needed to cover fixed overhead costs like bonds on bond obligations on residential facilities and things like that we simply had to pay. Anyway, in 4 years, we're back to financial health because the program was big enough to be able to create economies of scale and be able to be operated within the money that otherwise would have been used to pay for residential programs. There are a few things that we have learned. There's lots and lots and lots of things we've learned. Some of them about the how to run a wraparound program, what it's really all about, and those kinds of things. And the other things that we have learned are like major kind of systems lessons. I think that one of the most important lessons learned is that this kind of a change is a massive systems change effort. and no one agency or entity, whether it's the state or an individual agency, can do this, can think they're going to change and everything's going to work out. Because basically what has to happen is everybody has to change together. Some of the fundamental attitudes of the systems will be challenged directly by the values and philosophy of a wraparound or community-based care approach. By and large, the mental health system has historically tended to think of parents as part of the problem. They tended to blame parents for the kids' problems, and the mental health system has tended to think that the therapist knows best, and that if families would just listen to the therapist and do what they're told, things will be all right. That's kind of a prevailing mindset. The prevailing mindset in child welfare systems tends to be, we have to save these poor children from their bad families, from their bad parents. And by the way, not only are their parents bad, but probably all their uncles and aunts and grandparents are bad too. It's, you know, people don't say that out loud, but those kinds of biases kind of sit there under the table. I think that one of the things that's really, really important to think about as this kind of change effort goes forward is this is a major, major systems change effort. It's not just the introduction of a new program. A lot of the fundamental principles and values, for example, family-centered, strengths-based, needs-driven, individualized, parent voice and choice, will directly challenge and confront the existing assumptions that are prevalent in the services systems. And a lot of those attitudes are right there in the minds and hearts of therapists too, and all those things get challenged. There's fundamental changes in consciousness and attitudes towards parents and about the appropriate roles of various players and systems are probably going to be necessary, both at the individual clinician level and at various systems level. And systems change is cyclical and iterative. It doesn't occur in a nice, smooth line. It goes up and down and backward and forward. And you, as in this kind of systems change effort, you have to bring the dependency judges with you. You have to bring the district attorney's office along with you. You have to bring the public defender's office along with you in terms of understanding and embracing the new attitudes and philosophy. The way we started all this out is even before we started Wraparound, we had done a visioning process where we had kind of collectively imagined what would the best child welfare mental health organization agency in the country look like. What would it feel like to be a part of it? What would it feel like to be the parent of a child who went there for help? And we did a really extensive process trying to imagine in a collective way what could be, as opposed to thinking about what was wrong with what was. We dreamt about what could be, and we try to paint a picture of what that might be. That freed us up to do things like shut down 100 residential beds. If we hadn't done that visioning process, shutting down 100 of 130 residential beds would have felt way, way, way too radical. But because we said, okay, let's take off our existing assumptions about who we are and what we believe in and what business we're in and rethink everything. That was all a part of the visioning process that really freed us up a lot. Another thing I think that would really be helpful to think about is I think it would be very helpful for government agencies to think about building real partnerships with provider agencies rather than simply thinking about the provider agencies as being vendors. I think you really have to go beyond the purchaser-vendor kind of mentality into a partnership mentality about how can we work together to meet the needs of kids and their families in the community. A lot of companies in the for-profit sector have learned, once they've made a commitment to total quality and then continuous improvement, that they can get much better quality by building long-lasting partnerships with their vendors rather than subjecting them to competitive bidding based on who's going to do it cheapest every 2 years. It's really hard to build quality in that kind of a way. Another thing that we paid a lot of attention to is change management. And we think of ourselves as an organization as being in the change management business rather than in the mental health business or child welfare business. and we have done a lot of teaching of our management staff in change management and how to move an organization from where it is to where you want it to be. And there's a lot of knowledge out there in the field, that, and not necessarily in the nonprofit field or the government field, but in the for-profit field about how to manage change. And I think we should be paying a lot more attention to learning those techniques and teaching them to our key people.
Mm-hmm.
Another really major, I think, thing that we need to always be focused on is outcomes. Are the kids getting better or not, and how do we know? And we should be more focused on outcomes than we are on cost, because if we get the outcomes right, eventually the cost will come down. The other question that comes up in these kinds of change efforts is, well, when do you try to do it? One of the things I would be cautious about is I would not try to make this kind of change effort in the middle of a major state budget cut or major state budget problems, because then it's almost inevitable that the major focus is going to be on reducing costs as opposed to getting improved outcomes. And I don't think it's cheaper to do this, at least not in the first few years. It may, over time, get cheaper once you get up to scale and once you get into a place where you can begin to invest the money in prevention. But in the beginning, you really have to make an investment up front. You have to make an investment in terms of training and technical assistance and teaching people to do what it is that you want them to do and embedding the values and philosophies in the workforce, not just in a single agency, but in the workforce for the child welfare agency, the mental health agency, the probation agency. Just as an example of that, one of the first things that happened when we made the decision to shut down our residential beds and start wraparound, one of the first impacts on the child welfare staff line workers was they were afraid they were going to lose their jobs because they thought that they were placement workers and their job was to place kids in group homes. And if they weren't going to be placing kids in group homes, what was going to happen to them? So we had to address that, you know, basic survival concern from the line staff. And unless we addressed that, they wouldn't make any referrals to the program, and the program would die in the vine. So you really have to be thinking about this thing on multiple different levels. The other thing I don't think you could overemphasize is the need for training and technical assistance. You know, we did massive amounts of training. Initially, we brought in national experts from around the country to help with the training our own staff. And then as we started moving the program forward and tracking the outcomes, we were able to prove that it was getting really good outcomes. The wraparound program was getting much, much better outcomes than the traditional residential approaches had gotten. And we were publishing those outcomes and making them known to policymakers and legislators and folks like that. At that point, the folks from Los Angeles County came to look at our wraparound program, and because at that time it was just in Santa Clara County, still the demonstration project. And LA County came to look at it, and they decided they wanted to have wraparound in LA. So they went to another legislator, Senator Solis, and they asked her to carry legislation to add Los Angeles County to the wraparound demonstration project in Santa Clara County. We got very involved in that, and our main concern, we'd always wanted wraparound to become a statewide effort in California, but our concern was that people would do any old thing and call it wraparound, and it wouldn't be true to the principles and the values, and it wouldn't get the outcomes that are possible, and it would discredit the whole concept of wraparound. So basically what we were able to get into that second piece of legislation was a requirement that the State Department of Social Services would develop statewide wraparound standards that any program wanting to be part of this pilot demonstration effort would have to meet. Subsequent to that, the state actually hired us, EMQ, to develop statewide standards for wraparound, which are available on the state website. They're on the EMQ website as well. But any provider in California that wants to do wraparound has to meet those standards. The Gary had mentioned earlier, family finding. We are always looking for innovations and new ways to do things. And one of the things we're always doing is looking around the country and around the world, the other agencies that have learned things. And we learned about family finding from Catholic Community Services in Tacoma, Washington. Mary Stone Smith, as some of you may know, and Kevin Campbell was there at the time. And basically what they had learned, they had actually learned some stuff from the Mormons. So the Mormons, as you may know, do family genealogies, very extensive genealogies. And based on the genealogies that the Mormons have done, they learned that the average American has between 150 and 250 living relatives. That includes all these kids in the foster care system, many of whom are thought to have no family members or no family. And it's possible now, using internet search tools, to find relatives of these kids much, much more easily and much, much more quickly than it was 10 or 15 years ago. The first child we did, is just a little anecdote, the first child we did family finding with was a 12-year-old girl who was in the county children's shelter. She was depressed and suicidal. She had been in multiple group home placements, residential placements, bounced out of a lot of them, was suicidal, was cutting on her wrists and cutting on herself. Using the search tools, within 2 days, we were able to find this child's grandmother in New York. We called the grandmother and told her who we were and why we were calling, and she just started to cry. As soon as she found out why we were calling, she started to cry, and she said, "Oh, my God, I can't believe it." She said, I haven't heard anything from my daughter in 11 years. She was a year old last time I heard anything from her. I have had completely lost touch with her. Every day I prayed to God to help me find her again. And now she's been found. She said, "I would do anything for my granddaughter. I'd be willing to sell my home in New York and move to California if she needs me to." But she said, she also has an uncle and aunt that live in San Jose, and I'm sure they'd be delighted to meet with her and hear from her. A couple weeks later, we did a family reunification. The uncle and aunt set up a family reunification for the girl, and she met 150 uncles and aunts and cousins that she didn't know she had. And her depression magically disappeared. She quit cutting on herself. We started some visits with the uncle and aunt, and within 6 months, the girl was able to be moved back to live with her uncle and aunt. Her grandma visits her regularly from New York. She goes to New York to visit her grandma, and this kid's like a normal kid now because she's got hope and she belongs.
Jerry, we'll have to wrap it up, I think.
Yeah.
Thanks.
One of the things I'd really like us all to be thinking about is, what if we did family finding right at the front end of the system before we removed a kid at all from their natural family?
Before
they go through 10 or 15 placements, we could just save enormously that way.
That's so great. Gary, thank you so much. That is a great overview of your agency and the experience that you had in developing your program, and the funding is such an interesting story. And then this list of lessons that you've learned that I think are very relevant to public agencies. That's really helpful. Thanks so much.
You're
great. I think what would make the most sense is, I'd like to give Bob Lieberman a few minutes to just talk with us about the work that his association has done and the commitment they've made to transforming residential services and his experience with building bridges in his agency. Why don't we just give him a few minutes to do that, and then we'll see if we have time for a question or two before we have to end.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, Mary and Jerry. Thanks so much. The lessons learned were fabulous. I've heard some of the story before about what you've done, but that's a really great summation. American Association of Children's Residential Centers has been in around for 51 years, and it's kind of the old line, traditional residential in its genesis. In 1999, we had a speaker come from the University of Washington who challenged us to turn residential inside out. Mm-hmm. And that set in motion a series of, at our annual conference every year, which are uniformly really excellent. We made a commitment early on, and I did when I was president of the group, to the Carter Center, that we would focus every year, some of our conference, on linking residential with community systems. So basically, because it was the right thing to do and supported by research, and also because the traditional residential is just not really a viable service in its old form, we began a public policy kind of push, really not legislatively, but more within the executive branch administratively, and within the field, really programmatically, to look at redefining residential. So we've put out a series of position papers. One is redefining the role of residential, and all of these are on links on our website. we're basically putting out short pieces that are challenging people to think through what are they doing in their residential facilities and what can they do to become more fully integrated within the community. The second paper was family-driven care in residential, which raised all the questions about are we putting families in the driver's seat and what is the mindset around families. And I think Jerry's summary of the mindset issues is very apt and very much still present, I think, in the systems within which we work. Third paper we put out was about transformation, but really it was about licensure, that transformation and recreating and getting creative is not really that possible without a foundation of licensure regulation and both accreditation standards as well as internal quality and outcome kinds of standards. The fourth paper is going to be coming out really soon, within a few weeks, and that's performance measurement and outcomes. Performance indicators and outcomes in residential and speaking to designing systems that really begin to show what we're doing in residential linked with community systems. So AACRC was, I think, one of the key players in the early genesis of the Building Bridges Initiative. We've had a real feature in our conferences each year on family-driven, youth-guided. Our conferences a couple weeks ago, and we had a young man named Marvin Alexander who just lit up the house from a youth perspective about what is important when we're thinking about residential linked with community. And it's really his comments were not anti-residential necessarily. He just talked about how to do it better, how to do it best, how to do it right in shorter length of stay and linked with community. We're looking at a lot of different research that's out there. There is some research about the effectiveness of residential. Gary's comments early on about it's more what happens within than afterwards, I think, is very apt. There's a fellow named John Lyons, who's the editor of our journal, who is coming up with some excellent research out of Illinois about the types of kids for whom short stays in residential are showing to be effective. And what his research is showing is when it's property aggression, aggression against property, high anxiety, attentional kinds of problems, a residential isn't very effective. When it's suicidality and aggression against persons, he's finding more effectiveness in residential treatment settings, talking about more of the mental health psychiatric settings. That's a real quick overview related to AACRC. I wanted to comment about building bridges. I do co-chair the Outcomes Committee, and to the earlier question, the matrix that we're coming up with has assessment standards, performance indicators, and outcomes, and it's about the bridges. So it's what happens in the community when a residential episode is being contemplated, what happens during residential in terms of maintaining active integral linkages with the community, and what happens post-residential and that re-entry into the community. And my opinion is that if you take all these indicators and implement them in a community system that includes residential, you get very permeable boundaries and a very fluid kind of treatment that can incorporate wraparound before, during, and after residential, actually continuous through a residential episode, and create a real integrated system. At some point soon, we can get that out to the folks on this call. I think we're vetting that matrix right now and trying to call it down. Next steps will be to convert the matrix through the Building Bridges process into a self-assessment tool that a community or a system or an agency can use to assess how are they doing against the values and principles of the and practices of the Building Bridges resolution and against this matrix. And then we're hoping for some resources to pilot this matrix in a few sites around the country and see if it's got some validity as a unifying report card, performance report card that might be embraced somehow by states or nationally. To my agency real quickly, because I know we're short on time, we began in 1999, it was actually coming out of that AACRC conference, to redefine ourselves as family and community focused as opposed to child focused. And there's been a number of things we've done, and I'll just hit on several of them. We put in place a pilot project within a vehicle that was created in the state of Oregon to link residential and community, and in it was small W wraparound types of principles. It would not have qualified to the California standards by any stretch, but it was an initial step, and in 3 years we delivered 1,409. We're a small agency, 24 beds. We delivered 1,409 additional client days of service at no additional cost with the same or better measured outcomes using the CAFIS instrument in that pilot project. As part of that, then, we began really implementing family-driven aspects of care. I would not say we're fully family-driven. But our milieu is wide open. Parents come and go. Sometimes they're absolutely a part of things, helping kids get up, get to breakfast, get to school. If it's indicated, we serve a six-county region, about 200-mile radius. And if it's indicated, we'll give them a cot to sleep in the room overnight with their child. We call them as things are happening to see what they would do in tough situations. We find the families to be a great, great resource. So that mindset change is one piece that we've really been able to put in place in the agency. Currently, actually, the system surrounding us, and this is where the community indicators are really important, has not moved forward with us in pace. And so our efforts to link community and residential are a little bit cumbersome right now, but we have a plan in place to try to improve that with our local payers. At the same time, we diversified into treatment foster care. We've opened up a very intensive psychiatric day treatment program that's integrated into a public school setting. We have one-third of our board are parents or former clients of the organization, and we have a school-based mental health project, which is mental health-informed, system of care principles oriented in some local public schools. It's getting great, great results, and I say mental health-informed. It's way out of the box. So the presentation we have about it is called Mental Health Unshackled, and it really is about giving mental health away, which I've heard Gary say many times. So we've been nominated for Robert Wood Johnson Grant and made it into the second round and are really hoping to get that kind of support to expand it here and test it potentially as a national model. So that's a real quick overview of our national association and how we're trying to apply some of the principles here in Southern Oregon.
That's fantastic. That's great. This is Mary O'Brien. I'm afraid that we are at the end of our time, and so I apologize for running out of time there. We're not going to have time probably for questions for these two representatives from provider organizations. What I would say is that in the handouts for today's call on our website, there's a document called Agenda and Contact Information, and there's emails and phone numbers for both of these provider representatives. I'm sure they'd be happy to answer some questions by email if you have something pressing you'd like to ask. I think the other thing is you feel free to send questions to the Help Kids email, which is on our website, and I could get some answers and put them up on the website for everyone to see. So that's really great. Bob, thank you so much for that that overview of the work of the association and also the work in your provider agency. This has been a great call overall. Thank you, everyone for coming. Thanks to all the presenters, Gary Blau and Kathy Moles and Jerry Doyle and Bob Lieberman. Thank you all. I want to ask people who are on the lines to fill out an evaluation. We in the email that you got with the phone number for today's call, there's a link to an online web-based evaluation form. We do really appreciate your feedback and use it to plan our calls to make them work better for people. So we do appreciate that feedback. You'll also be getting an email with that link. If you haven't gotten it now, it'll be coming soon so that you can have a reminder to fill in an evaluation form for us. Thank you very much for that. These calls are recorded, and the audio file will be up on our website by tomorrow. So if anyone would like to listen to parts of it or have other people listen to parts of it, you can go ahead and do that on our website. You can also contact us for a CD if that's easier for you. We'll be having one more call this fall on November 29th and involving families in the CFSR process. You're welcome to join us for that if that interests you. And thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the conference. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.